Well, it's great to see everybody here this evening. For many of you who do not know me yet, my name is Steve Hussman. I am the Director of Special Collections. I want to welcome all of you here tonight. This is our official fall kickoff for our events and activities for this year. This evening, we present 1968, From Mi Lai Massacre to the Yellow Submarine. And as many of us know, many participated in the Vietnam anti-war movement. Many people participated in this adventure in order to put pressure on our government to pull out of Vietnam through underground presses and demonstrations. According to Tom Miller, this evening's presenter, critically acclaimed author and author of Cuba Hot and Cold and the Panama Hat Trail, the underground press was a, quote, joyously sloppy endeavor made up of people who knew little about journalism but had strong feelings about the war and the cultural life it spawned, unquote. This evening, he'll draw upon his own experiences that occurred in 1968, including his work in the underground press and how the rest of the country reacted to the anti-war movement. I should point out that in 2002, University of Arizona Library Special Collections Department acquired Tom's personal archives, and some of his materials have been included in our current exhibit in the gallery that you see right now. Many of you will also want to share some of your own personal stories while viewing our newly installed exhibit, 1968 in America, created and curated by Bob Diaz, our curator for Performing Arts and Architectural Collections, which will run from September 4th until December 2nd, 2018. Bob will be offering further introductions to tonight's presenter, but first, I'd like you to stand up and give Bob a round of applause for his work on this exhibit. Okay, Bobby, you're warmed up.
You're tuned to 91.3 KNCI Tulsa. That's my other title. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming. Such a pleasure to see so many people here, so many familiar faces and new faces. My name is Bob Diaz. I've been a librarian here since 1992, student since 1977. So this is home. And mi casa es su casa, is what we say in Spanish. I hope you enjoyed the exhibit. It was a labor of love, and as I was putting it together, my idol Aretha Franklin passed on, so I decided to dedicate the whole thing to her, and it's in her memory. I've known this guy since I was a kid, 1982, something like that. Tom Miller is a good friend of my friends, Ron and Jane Cruz. I don't know if they're here yet.
Yeah, they are.
Ron and Jane. Oh, I'm so glad to see you. Ron and Jane came all the way from Washington, D.C. To visit, and it just so happened that all of this was taking place. They're my mentors. They're responsible for the little troublemaker you see up here. Anyway, I love you dearly, and thank you for coming. And Tom and Jane worked together way back in the early 80s. Jane indexed the book On the Border for Tom, and I was a kid at South Point, and they were my teachers, and Tom was a writer. So over the years, I've been aware of Tom's works as a librarian. I tried to buy his books for our collections and whatnot. And in 2005 or 6, we collaborated on a program. It was called La Bamba Part 2, and it was a radio show, and I provided all the different versions of La Bamba, and Tom did a program with Rose Lady. And our mutual love of music is pretty clear, and I love going through his archive. There's so much incredible stuff in his papers. I encourage you to visit and come and see what Tom has left for us. A lot of the material in the exhibit comes from his papers, including all the underground press materials and the posters and other stuff. And Tom wants me to be sure to encourage you all to buy his books. Yes,
I did it, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So I wasn't going to take a lot of time up here. It wasn't my intention to go on and on. And so I'm going to stop and introduce Mr. Tom Miller to you.
How are we doing here? Very good. Everybody can hear me?
This is somewhat of an audience participation show, so I'm encouraging people to take part in responding to observations that I make and that others make. I'm going to start with the obvious. Journalists love anniversaries, especially lazy journalists. The work is done for them. All they have to do is just update the raw facts. But there's something different about the year 1968, about the days between January 1st and December 31st of that year. And this evening, we're going to try and squeeze 366 days into 60 minutes. I'm going to concentrate on the little known and personal, leaving the Chicago riots and the My Lai massacre to your own research. In recent weeks, we've all been flooded with newspaper and television and NPR coverage of 1968, the Democratic Convention, and the 18-hour Ken Burns gave us last September about Vietnam. So I'm going to start by asking, how many of you were alive in 1968? Well, that's very impressive. That's very impressive. So let me get some of the lesser things out of the way. 1968, Led Zeppelin was formed. 1968, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention performed as Reuben and the Jets. The Doors played at the Crosstown Bus in Boston. I know this because I saw them there. And the sport of Ultimate Frisbee was created. If you went to a bookstore in 1968, this is what you'd find, Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver. Yeah. The Algiers Motel incident by John Hersey about the riots in Detroit the previous year. Likewise, you'd find The Confessions of Nat Turner by William Styron. From Kurt Vonnegut, you'd find a collection of short stories called Welcome to the Monkey House. If you went to a bookstore in 1968, you'd find Norman Mailer, Armies of the Night, about the March on the Pentagon the previous year. 1968, John Steinbeck died at age 66. From the sports desk, the U of A Wildcat football team went 8-3. The basketball team went 11-13, and to prove it, we have a cheerleader from 1968 wearing his 1968 cheerleader. Could you stand up, please?
Okay, give me a T.
That's enough. That summer, the Detroit Tigers beat the St. Louis Cardinals in the 1968 World Series. Earlier that year, Green Bay beat the Oakland Raiders in the Super Bowl. Some of you have been watching the U.S. Open. 50 years ago, Arthur Ashe became the first African-American to win the U.S. Open. In Tucson, there was another type of violence that went on. Homes were torn down that year in the Barrio Viejo to make way for the Tucson Community Center. This was sort of citizens versus Chamber of Commerce conflict. And the Chamber of Commerce won. It was the same year in which Cesar Chavez held his 25-day water-only fast in Delano, California. In the arts world here in Tucson, artists primarily from the U of A Art College, Art Department, settled into a community outside of Oracle, Arizona, just north of Tucson. They called it Rancho Linda Vista. It still exists. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were formed that year. 1968, Dusty Springfield recorded La Bamba. One normally associates Jane Fonda with protesting the war in Vietnam, but in 1968, she was best known for the movie Barbarella. And speaking of movies, Rosemary's Baby came out that year. The Graduate won all sorts of awards. And yes, Yellow Submarine came out with Blue Meanies Attacking Pepperland. One of the biggest hits on Broadway was Hair. Martin Luther King was speaking around the country. His popularity was decreasing somewhat, partly because of other black movements and partly because he was expanding the civil rights movement into the anti-war movement to combine the two, showing how one reflected the other. In 1968, a dominant event took place thousands of miles away in Asia, in Vietnam. The French had tried to take the country and failed. Now it was the U.S. turn. It was brutal as wars tend to be, but it also changed the personalities of the participants. The message that commanders in the field gave was this: kill anything that moves. And I very nicely have a book by that name and recommend it to you all. It's not my book, someone else's. The worst circumstance that we all came to know was the My Lai massacre. It was actually more than one hamlet. It was more than My Lai. It was a few other villages and hamlets in the nearby area. And it wasn't just that time of the year. But the My Lai massacre became well known the following year by the work of a journalist soldier named Ron Reidenauer, and primarily by a journalist named Seymour Hersh, who is still out and kicking and still doing research and still publishing books. I'm not going to go into the details of the war, of course, or the destruction of the entire villages, but what was going on here, there, and everywhere was notable on television for the first time for a war. I will say that in the Americas, the Olympics were held that summer in Mexico, something that was done of pride by the Mexican president, Gustavo Diaz Ordaz. He wanted Mexico to be on the international stage, and it had never been up to that point. So here was the opportunity. The Olympics were taking place in the summer of 1968, and Gustavo Diaz Ordaz was as proud as he could be. Yet in the weeks leading up to the Olympics, students demonstrated in Mexico City, including the community of Tlatelolco. Diaz Ordaz sent troops in to mow down the demonstrators. The number killed an estimated more than 100. This is what the students wanted. First, the release of political prisoners. Second, reduction of the Olympic budget. Next, elimination of the punitive penal code. Compensation for police brutality, the firing of the abusive police chief, and the disbanding of the Granaderos, the riot police. The students wanted transparency. They wanted mass media. They wanted participation. They demanded that the negotiations be broadcast on radio and television. Not one of their demands was met. Gustavo Diaz Ordaz, proud of Mexico, proud of having an international event, as I said, attacked the students, which of course made the circumstances far worse. At the 200-meter Olympic competition, two Americans won medals. And when they stood to receive their medals, they bowed their heads and raised black gloved fists, John Carlos and Tommy Smith. To show you how much things have changed over 50 years, quarterback for the 49ers, Colin Kaepernick, did the same a year or two ago, and now it's still being adjudicated. There are lawsuits. He's claimed that he's been blacklisted by the different NFL teams. It's still something that's very much in the news from 50 years on. The underground press, we had trouble justifying our margins. It was a sloppy, joyous, radical, poor businessman. We were all poor businessmen. At the Chicago convention, as the week drew on, thousands of people came in from around the Midwest primarily, but what started was a week or so prior to the Democratic Convention, there was a conference of college newspaper editors and underground press participants. This took place in Valparaiso, or is it Valparaiso, Indiana? Which one is it?
Valparaiso,
thank you. And there were two speakers there that impressed me. One was Abe Peck, who was the editor of the Chicago Seed, who told us all, you're gonna go to Chicago. They have not been cooperative. The police are real nasty motherfuckers. You don't want to be around them. If you go to Chicago, I encourage you to go to demonstrate, but there's going to be a lot of trouble. And this was APEC, who lived in Chicago and knew what was happening. The other person who was there who impressed me was John Sack. Yes, John Sack, who was a writer for Esquire, Atlantic, and he did a lot of long-form journalism, John Sack did. And he gave a talk. Most people were not paying much attention to him, but he gave a talk to the editors there, including myself, and said something so obvious it never occurred to any of us, and that is, don't go and cover the convention. There are much better reporters than you that are going. They're going to get published. People are going to read them. They're not going to read what you have to say. Go and find one little corner of the story and stick with it. And that's what I did. I found something called the Medical Committee for Human Rights, which was formed during the Civil Rights Movement a few years earlier. Medical Committee for Human Rights was essentially a white van with red tape on it indicating a red cross. And whenever they found somebody on the streets bloody, they would pull them into the van and treat them and then send them out and make room for the next guy. Among the people they found was Klaus Oldenburg, the famous artist. He was actually famous at the time. What do I have about Klaus Oldenburg? Quote from Klaus Oldenburg, which I recall at the time. I was hit on the lip by the police. Is this serious? This is as he comes into the van. Is this serious? They hit me in the stomach as I was leaving, calling me a commie cocksucker. Myself, I found the medical workers in the van mixed revolution, professionalism, and intensity. So I spent a day or two in the van, sort of crouched in the corner. The doctors who were working there, who were from all over the country, really pretty much ignored me after a while. So I was able to get a good story out of it and to use it since then, and to write it up for the underground press. What happened, there were not a whole lot of people in the first day or so of the Democratic Convention. I'm guessing 1,000, nothing more. But there is that saying, the whole world was watching. And in fact, television was broadcasting what was going on. And there was absolutely no difficulty all over the country. People could see what was going on with Mayor Richard Daley, with Abraham Ribicoff shouting back and forth at each other, calling each other Nazis and commie cocksuckers and everything in between. And as this accelerated and as the police got worse and worse, as the police riot got worse and worse, people from all over the Midwest, from Wisconsin, from Michigan, from Ohio, started coming in. And by the fourth day, there were tens of thousands of people there. Myself, I was writing articles and sending them off to places like the Berkeley Bar, the Berkeley Tribe, the LA Free Press, Dallas Notes, the Chicago Seed, the Dallas Iconoclast, Austin Rag, Great Speckled Bird from Atlanta, Boston Phoenix, alternative paper, the Village Voice. Did any of you read about the Village Voice in the last week or so?
Yeah.
It folded, it went under. For a while, it was just an online, went from paper to online and then strictly online, and it just gave up the ghost last week. It's very sad, but it just happened. So the war against Vietnam was heating up. The mood about the war was shifting. And during this time, the Selective Service, that is the draft, was accelerating and made it compulsory for young men 18 years of age or older to take part in the Selective Service. You had the choice of enlisting in the Army or another military branch, enrolling in college full time, leaving for Canada, as Jesse Winchester, the singer, did. You could resist the draft by disobeying the law and refusing to appear at the swearing in. You could take direct opposition to the war. Do any of you know what happened in Catonsville? Catonsville, Maryland, outside of Baltimore. The Berrigan brothers, two Jesuit priests, broke into the draft board office, pulled some files out of the drawers, took them outside. They had alerted the press, took them outside, and poured homemade napalm on the draft records. This was their way of resisting the draft. So millions of people did enroll in college, and they got a certain status that allowed them to stay away from the draft. There was a draft lottery in which they decided the best way to do this is just pick 365 days, and if your birthday happened to be on one of the days of 1 through 365, I think about the first 200 or so were people who were drafted. Then there's also disobedience, people who burned their draft cards in public displays of protest. April 1968, the National Draft Card Turn-In Day, about 1,000 turned in. in Tucson as one of the ways in which we were supporting the anti-war movement, a number of draft resistors, not those who were following the law, but resistors, were sentenced to different prisons around the country. Two of them, Jeff Siegel and David Harris, were assigned to the Swift Trail prison at Safford, Arizona, federal prison there. And we in Tucson would put up their visitors on the Sunday before they would go out to visit, and they would go out to visit to Safford, spend the day visiting their family, and come back to Tucson and then go off to their homes. I went out one Sunday helping some of the draft resistor families, and there in the corner of the visitor's patio was this very attractive lady with a newborn baby and her husband. It was David Harris and Joan Baez and their newly born son, Gabriel. David Harris had been assigned to Safford, and Joan was visiting, as usual, on a Sunday to see her husband. Then there were also conscientious objectors, those who claimed that they had a reason to oppose not just the Vietnam War, but all wars. And I have found in my files my 1968 draft card. This one. You get it here at Special Collections. I'm through with it. I will not burn it. No, I will not burn it. It's like Richard Nixon said about paying hush money to the Watergate burglars. I could do it, but it would be wrong. So it was serious business, this war protest, and it paralleled the counterculture. Some of you may remember the Sunday night, 8 p.m. on NBC, the Steve Allen Show, Tom Post and Louie Nye and Don Knotts. But Steve Allen was essentially a jazz musician, and he would take rock and roll songs and read them in a very Shakespearean manner. And if I find my notes here, I will do the same. You will recognize the song. I will read the lyrics. I will not sing it. I will read the lyrics. Well, come on, all you big strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. He's got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. So put down your books and pick up a gun. We're going to have a whole lot of fun. Some of you may remember Country Joe and the Fish. Well, come on, generals, let's move fast. Your big chance has come at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, because the only good commie is the one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when we've blown them all to kingdom come. Come on, mothers throughout the land, pack your boys off to Vietnam. Come on, fathers, and don't hesitate to send your sons off before it's too late. And you can be the first ones on your block to have your boy come home in a box. And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7, open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no reason, there ain't no time to wonder why, whoopee, we're all gonna die. Counterculture from the Vietnam War. Steve Allen, apologies to Steve Allen. When you get to Columbia University, was anyone by any chance in this room at Columbia University in the spring of 1968? Nobody. But you've read about it. You've seen film footage of it. This is at buildings with the name Lowe, Hamilton. Then there were black groups that were taking over a building. It was a major, not just anti-war protest, but it was a major protest against the management of the university. The president of the university was named Grayson Kirk. Prior to him, the president of the university was, curiously enough, Dwight Eisenhower, before he became U.S. president. In fact, one of the things that the anti-war movement was terrible at was slogans. And I will now tell you the worst slogan that existed, or that I heard over a 15-year period. Eisenhower to Grayson Kirk, Columbia goes from jerk to jerk. But there were better slogans. Ho, ho, Ho Chi Minh, NLF is going to win. Make love, not war. Then the line from the Pete Seeger song, we were waist deep in the big muddy, and the damn fool says to push on. Any more slogans anyone can think of from...
Hell no, we won't go.
Hell no, we won't go. Thank you. Yes. In the midst of all this, Martin Luther King is killed. There are riots throughout urban America. Robert Kennedy, who visited the U of A, there are photographs of him at the U of A outside. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, there are photographs of him here at the university in late March of that year. I want to leave the United States and go to Europe. One of the places we'll visit will be Czechoslovakia. And Dr. Tansky, could you stand up and give us a minute or so on what took place in 1968?
I know 1968 in Prague mainly from stories of my parents. And if I can say in few words, that was a year of frustration. Czechs came in very peaceful protests, and Russians and students and whole nation just decided to change the regime, and hopefully the idea was to have a less of a communist oppression, and the Russians responded with tanks and came to Prague and kind of violently suppressed us. What's not known that much is that next year, one of the students, out of frustration, set himself on the fire, and his name is Jan Palach. So if you ever go to Prague, make sure you visit his, there is a square named after him and also a statue. And then Czechs had to wait another 20 years for 89 when we had our Velvet Revolution, and that was finally peaceful and not suppressed by the Russians.
Very good, thank you. Also international, there are some coup attempts against Papadoc Duvalier in Haiti. Throughout Europe, there are university students and trade unionists in revolution. The countries with Romance languages, Portugal, Spain, Italy, and throughout Latin America, south of Mexico, and Argentina, Uruguay, Ecuador, and Brazil, there is even violence at the University of Madrid. In the Basque country of Spain, ETA, ETA, formed and finally got their operations in gear. Finally, in France, there were major trade union demonstrations against de Gaulle and against the government and against the war, against the United States. I wrote to a friend of mine in France a couple weeks ago, asked if he recalls what was going on. He writes back, "I was 12 in my first year of junior high, living in Paris at the heart of the Latin Quarter. I can tell you that, although I did not understand much, I got an incredible eyeful and earful. I remember listening at night excitedly under my bed linens to the reports by the journalists on the barricades. My brother was doing his military service in Paris that year, and I remember going to see him along the Boulevard Saint-Michel, putting burnt cars on military trucks to clear the streets after the riots of the previous night." This is an eyewitness account of what was going on in France at the time. There were even demonstrations in England. We've had the war in Asia, we've had assassinations, we have draft resistors, we have counterculture. And now I want to, so many of you were participants or observers of what was going on, can I get some of you to raise your hands and explain what you saw and what you took part in? Anyone, please? Nobody? Start, please.
Well, I think one of the interesting things were the silent vigils that were held town squares on Sundays after church, and I grew up in New England, there were always, on all the town squares, people just standing there witnessing, saying that the war had stopped.
There was some kind of demonstration in New York, we were told to, I was living in New York at the time, and there was a demonstration where we were told to wear our best clothes because we were called hippies and all this. So I was wearing a navy blue suit and high heels and marching in the street. And somebody and there were people with babies and in strollers marching with us. And there was somebody on the fourth floor in right in the middle of the city who dumped down a can of red paint on top of us because we were commies, and just missed killing somebody. I mean, it was a big, heavy can of paint coming down from about the fourth floor, and splashed all over my suit. And I went into a Hornet Harlot that was there, and into the restroom where a bag lady helped me clean up my my suit, and was very horrified by what had happened. Although she didn't really understand the whole situation, but she thought it was terrible. My suit was ruined.
I'm surprised that Hornet Harlot is still there. Yes.
I participated in the sit-in at Old Bay.
Another 68?
Yeah.
Oh, very good, very good. Can you tell us a little more about it?
I don't know, I just remember I was going to class and people were all sitting out on the steps and it looked like a good place to sit down. A good excuse to hang out with everyone.
But there was a demonstration at Old Main the following year as well. One thing I would think we should push for is to have a plaque at Old Main commemorating this major series of events in the late 60s. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, this is the time of teach-ins. Remember teach-ins? Anyway, we used to man the tables at the student union and give out literature about the war. And I got a lot of support from the American Friends Association, the Quakers, about, you know, how to look at life and the war. And I registered as a conscientious objector when I was a student here. Gave up the student deferment so I'd be more believable. It got turned down.
Oh, I'm sorry. It got turned down, and luckily I had a lucky draft number, so I didn't have to go. I had appealed it, and they said, oh, I'm not going to act on your appeal because you have a number that probably won't get called. So, you know, yeah.
Are there those of you who remember Ed Morgan, an attorney?
Yeah.
Within the last year or so, but he worked as a draft counselor for anybody who needed help at that time.
I was at Cornell, and we were having teach-ins every night at Barton Hall all night long with all sorts of speakers, including the Berrigan brothers.
Where were you at the time?
Cornell.
Okay.
Yeah, upstate New York. And I think to avoid violence, there were uprisings on all sorts of campuses, and to avoid having the National Guard come in, Cornell actually canceled classes and we all went home. No finals.
What happened at Columbia was, at the graduation at Columbia, Grayson Kirk decided not to attend because it would just be too provocative. Things of that nature took place a lot. Before we have you speak, there are two books here, Kill Anything That Moves, I'm recommending, and also recommending a book by Mark Kurlansky, 1968, the year that rocked the world. I'd recommend that if you're interested in following up on 68, that either of these would be a good start. Yes, sir.
In 1968, I remember having graduated here in the art department in 1963, my professor Andy Rush and Charles Littler, later in 1968, created Rancho Linda Vista. Mm-hmm. But at that time, I was living in Chicago in the suburbs. I had moved, we'd finally achieved success, moved North Shore to the suburbs. And we went to see Tom Hayden. We were spending $25 to have him tell us how terrible things were. And we were getting together all the sort of yuppie people and protesting and realizing we needed to stay away from Lincoln Park, which is where the riots were taking place with Mayor Daley. So I would be at the merchandise mart, but I would take a very circuitous route from the North Shore in and go nowhere near it, and then watch everything on television and be glad I was alive that night. Years later, when I would come back to visit Andy and Charles out of Rancho Linda Vista, the one thing I remember mostly was that you would go to the bathroom and there would be a sign and say, if you don't need to flush, don't. And you would debate about how bad it was that you should or shouldn't flush.
Hi. I was at a Catholic girls' school, and our nuns were very political. So we talked about the war all the time. We went to demonstrations. And these were the Sisters of Loretto, who are still doing fantastic work. anyway, Daniel Berrigan came to our school, and it was a school where we did mass every day, so he said the mass, and afterwards he talked about the war and what was going on, and then he said, are there any questions? And this young woman raised her hand and said, is French kissing really a mortal sin?
Were the Berrigans Jesuits? Do I have that right?
Pardon?
Do you happen to know, were the Berrigans Jesuits?
Yes. Yes.
They were. Okay.
They were.
Go ahead.
The smart priests.
So, 1968, we heard about Prague. I lived on the other side. So, as soon as the Russians marched in, my parents took the entire family and went shopping. No, not a joke, because we were afraid we had to run. So my parents needed to make sure we had all good shoes, good sweater, in the middle of the summer, to be ready to run. Because we were afraid that the Russians would not stop in Prague, would come west, namely the Fulda Gap. Some of you might have heard of the Fulda Gap. That's where the Third World War was supposed to start. And we were afraid of being forced to run. It didn't happen.
Well, I was in middle school in 1968, and the Yaqui communities of Guadalupe and Tucson, Arizona, of course, the young men didn't have very many options, so they went to war. And still today, if you really look at how many Native Americans serve the military as a percentage, it's the highest number, even today. And it goes back to the Royal Society. And so when I go back and listen to all those that were part of the service, because again, they didn't have too many choices, right? Some of you went to college, Peace Corps. They probably didn't have very many choices, but they probably served. And it's amazing that so many returned back and they said, you know, Diana, it's because of our prayers, our ceremonies, las mandas, the vows. And that's why so many, because everybody was praying for us to return, and we did it.
In 1968, I was in the military. I was stationed in the Azores, of all places, supporting the, as a medic, supporting the Apollo missions. And it was also during that time when I became a sort of secret correspondent for Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Ironically, that was a few months before I actually went to Vietnam. But it was also a year where I saw Led Zeppelin play the first gig at the Fillmore East. So it indeed was a very memorable time.
We have one over here.
In 1968, I hitchhiked from Tucson to Mexico City. It was during the summer riots. And I met a Mexican girl in Mexico City, and we went to the different polytechnical school and different places where there were riots going on. And anyway, I was kind of liked her, but she invited me home to her house in the rich suburbs of Mexico City, and for chocolate milk. And I remember sitting at the kitchen table, and she got really angry at the maid because the chocolate milk was warm. She started screaming and had a temper tantrum. And that was kind of the end of my adventure in Mexico City.
We have a couple over here as well.
Let's give Erica a big hand.
Well, in 1968, I was a freshman at the San Francisco Art Institute. I'd been going to school there with the GI Bill. I had just gotten out of the military in October 67, so I missed the tent, which was good. And part of being a freshman San Francisco Art Institute at the time, you had to be careful about what you said if you wanted to have a relationship with someone. You couldn't say na, boku,
or anything else that related to the Vietnam War. And what happened is that all the veterans gradually joined together, and we all of a sudden realized it's all the veterans talking to each other. And none of us would go to the anti-war protests because we still had them. Brothers in arms. What the heck?
In 1968, I was a student here at the University of Arizona. And since the University of Arizona is a land-grant college, all male students had to volunteer 2 years of their lives in ROTC, Reserve Officers Training Corps. And so we had some enthusiastic colonel teaching us at the Old Main how to actually verbatim read the Army manuals. Not even read, said them, he memorized them. And we also had to, the field is now buildings, we had parade, and we had to wear a Army uniform and march. And what I would do after the march required, I would go home, change clothes, and participate in protests. And as you shared, Tom, I was eventually drafted while I was at school. And I had decided I was going to be a conscientious objector. And evidently my blood pressure got so high that I was called up by to the person in charge, an officer, and he said, Mr. Cruz, I'm sorry to inform you that we cannot accept you because you have extremely high blood pressure. And they bugged me for like 6 months. And then the lottery came out and there was a high number, so I escaped.
Congratulations.
In 1968, I was with my wife and my three children here in Tucson, working for the railroad. And at the height of the Vietnam War, we hauled a lot of bombs and miscellaneous equipment for the military. Just east of Benson one night, a car caught on fire. And the car was full of bombs, and they blew up. And it was so fortunate that they didn't come into Benson. And they got that wreck cleared up, and it took a while. And the rest of the train came into Tucson, and one of the cars got put down by the freeway, Prince Road, at the feed and grain store to unload a carload of grain. Well, they started unloading the car, and they couldn't figure out why it wouldn't dump into the wrecks underneath the track. So they got on top and they lifted the doors up, and there was a huge bomb that had blown up into the air and dropped to the top of the car and didn't explode.
This is a piece of Arizona history which should be repeated.
In 1968, I was the photo editor of the Arizona Daily Wildcat. And we were writing, our editor, Jay Parker, was writing all kinds of wonderful editorials. And the business manager came to me and said, we need you to shoot a fashion magazine, a fashion supplement. And I went, Tony, we're fighting a war in Vietnam. This is not what we want to do. We don't need pictures of sorority girls in presses. And he goes, you know what, Tim? I don't really care what you think. We've got the advertisement set, and you have to shoot it. And so I said, just stand in my way, we're good. So 2.5 weeks later, Stan Turley, who was the president of the Arizona State Senate, stood with my fashion supplement in his hand, held aloft. On the front of that were two of my friends from the Invisible Theater who were sitting having breakfast at a table on the top of the hill at Gates Pass, Kellogg's breakfast cereals and spark naked. And I thought, that's my way of protesting.
Just to give you a little opposite to your point, I served in 1968. I was stationed in the Medical Corps of Japan, and it was much more conservative. But we treated many of the veterans who came in remained and injured. I also want to make a notation that most of them were not college grads. They were drafted and didn't have the opportunity of deferment. And I also remember very vividly, even though I personally was against the war, I was very appalled at Jane Fonda's Radio Hanoi, and so were most of the service people at that time.
A few more, please.
One thing I guess that other fellow mentioned was the medical deferments, but I know in Tucson there was a doctor who would find knee problems where they didn't exist, and I think there was a doctor in New York who would find bone spurs where they didn't exist.
And we have time for a few more.
I guess so. If we have time, this one, and then we'll move across the room.
In 1968, Barbara and I were in Kenya in the Peace Corps, getting our information mostly from the BBC, not trusting the Voice of America. One time we were hitchhiking and were picked up by two black Kenyans dressed in suits. I think I learned that they were legislators from the parliament, and they told us that Robert Kennedy had been shot and commiserated with us.
In 1968, I was in high school in Nashville, Tennessee, and I'm going to change the subject a little bit, but Martin Luther King Jr. was shot in Memphis, and immediately the riots spread throughout the cities in Tennessee, and there was one in Nashville, and they called martial law, and so there was curfew, well, not martial law, they called it curfew at night. So no one was allowed to go out at night, and I remember sitting around studying, and it was totally quiet there, which is very odd, and just kind of hit me. It's like, wow, this is really different.
I was also a high school student in 1968 in Los Angeles, California. I took off with my friend one weekend, went to San Francisco to go to the Fillmore West. Bill Graham induced the Grateful Dead that night, and we were kind of, and we'd been there, but it was just an open, basically, room. There were no chairs. It was just a place where you walked around and danced or just stood by. They had these basins of what looked like punch and plastic cups. A friend and I took a drink, and we only found out later a book that was published the same year, 1968, that we were part of the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Hey, I was living in Taipei, Taiwan. I was 12 years old, and my dad was in the Army, and I think he did some trips to Vietnam, but I didn't really know what was going on particularly. But when we came back to the U.S. a year or so later, I remember, or I guess I was in junior high or whatever, I remember wearing a black armband, and it was really radical to be able to wear pants as a girl at school, and bell bottoms were, you know, all the rage. But yeah, it was an interesting time to be overseas as well.
I was just five in 1968, one of three kids, and from like really conservative Wisconsin, and my dad had sort of grown his hair long and had a beard, and my mom hadn't kept up with him. In 68, they sold their house in Morocco. We moved out to the country to like live this natural life and eat our food from the garden. And my dad built himself a den, and he had that building a rainbow poster, and I'd rather be read the dead poster, and I sat in there and tried to understand it all. And they never did come together, and that was about the end of that marriage.
One time for one more. Two? Tom, up to you.
Go ahead.
Okay. Nobody's really mentioned this. In 1968, I was a junior in high school in Northern Virginia, suburbs of Washington. And everyone I went to high school with was military or diplomatic, except for my father, who worked for the Washington Post. No, he was from the business side. He was not a journalist. But we didn't have a TV until I was well into high school. But what I remember from 1968 was watching the police beat the crap out of demonstrators at the Chicago Convention. And I sort of, you know, I had noticed, I was a teenager. I was just interested in my own stuff. With the two assassinations and then watching that brutality on TV, that kind of just turned me around. That was the first time I paid any attention to what was going on outside of me.
Yeah. Okay, last two.
In 1968, I was a student up at that other university to the north, and a number of things happened there that were really interesting, personally and also in terms of the war particularly. You're very active up there in 1968. We ran the Marines off of the wall who had come to people. But one of the things that really moved me and moved me to become kind of permanently progressive and radicalized was watching the assassination of Robert Kennedy on TV. My husband at the time and I were watching the TV, and it was like, God, don't go to any lengths to shut us up. And they're still working at it, as you know. My husband and I split up shortly thereafter. We almost made it to our first anniversary that year. Unfortunately, that was the day that Russia invaded Czechoslovakia. And after that, we just didn't see eye to eye on most anything. I think he was embarrassed by my passion, by my work, by all the things that I thought were important to me and still are, which are freedom of speech, which are freedom of assembly, and moving us forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, last one.
Last one.
I'm Mike Brewer. I was at the University of Arizona and at Stanford that year at different times. My memories tend to telescope and I get kind of confused about what happened when with years. I remember having my soul just harrowed up, trying to figure out how to see clearly about what was going on back then. And I remember the passion of my father, Andre Brewer, against the war and the research he did. And he'd write editorials, and he and Dr. George Nash, the help of Congressman O. Udall, the first congressional hearings held locally here in Tucson about the war. I don't know if this is in our time frame here. But I remember those kind of things. I remember trying to decide to get up the courage for me at that time to resist the draft. I worked with Ed Morgan in his draft counseling service. And I was astonished at the number of people who just, they didn't have any principles why they didn't want to be drafted. They just didn't want to be drafted. And I was thinking that this is something of great principle. And I remember visiting a peace center near the Center for Democratic Institute, Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara, and the man who headed it up was 90 years old. I kind of made a pilgrimage there. And he asked me, how much of your time do you spend working for peace? And I don't know what my answer was, but he said, if you were my age, he's 90, he said, you'd be spending all your time working for peace. And I think that involves thinking clearly, and that's often hard to do when there's a lot of mass collective thinking going on around you. And I found that I didn't even understand the real origins of the Vietnam War until I saw the first couple of sections of the Ken Burns series. So I'm really realizing at any point in time how hard it is to know what's really going on.
Okay, thank you. A quick add about Cuba. It was called the Year of the Heroic Guerrilla in honor of the memory of Che Guevara, who had been killed the previous October in Bolivia. So I want to thank you all for coming this evening and close with these words. At the beginning of 1968, the United Nations issued the following. This will be the International Year for Human Rights. That was the year of human rights that we've just been talking about. And with that, I thank you very much for coming. There are refreshments, there are books, there's anything else you want. Thank you.